What's hard is, you know, people not getting it. What's hard is people cutting the check to your pseudonym.
Yeah, that's another
security. Yeah, I know the bank does not care what it says on my role-playing game.
So you need to set up a business account under your
pseudonym. I do, and I should never have that, but I should have that.
Did you try to cash a check with Xandor the Great?
$250.
No other. Did you try to cash in gold coins?
I would like that in Quatloos, please.
5 Quatloos for the newcomers.
Xandor shall vanquish all.
Excellent. Well, shall we get started?
Why not? We're all here, right?
All right.
So okay. Apparently, Tweet is supposed to moderate.
Who?
Jonathan.
Oh, cool.
But I haven't seen him at all, and I don't know that he knows he's supposed to moderate.
And you're out of chairs.
Well, we maybe, I bet he'd run around the audience like Ricky Lake.
Wow, I'm having a flashback. Wow, Ricky Lake.
Is. I'm old. You're lucky I didn't say Phil Donahue.
That's right. Mike Douglas. Like Mike Douglas used to, right?
Dick Van Dyke.
Well, I think we can go ahead and introduce ourselves.
Yes, I think that's a fine idea. Let's start with the guy on the left.
Oh,
yeah.
Your left?
My other one, yes.
Your military left.
Yeah.
My name is Matt Forbeck. I'm a freelance game designer and writer. I've been doing this for 20-some years. This is actually my 30th Gen Con in a row. I started coming when I was a kid, and I just love being here. It's always a great time. Today's my birthday. So. Spend your birthday, right? I got my eldest sons back here in the back row watching me and sharing my birthday with me here at Gen Con. So I used to run a company called Pinnacle Entertainment Group, which did Deadlands, Brave New World, a whole bunch of other games. I've written products for just about every company in the industry. Well, every bigger company in the industry. There's a lot of companies in the industry. And nowadays I mostly do novels. I had a couple of original novels called Immortals and Vegas Knights come out from Angry Robot this year. I just wrote a book called Star Wars vs. Star Trek that came out from Adams Media. I'm doing comic books, video games, toys, all sorts of stuff.
I just saw your novels last weekend when I was down at Powell's. And, I was walking down the aisle and it's like a four-bag section. I'm Stan, the guy with the exclamation point. I also have been in the industry quite a while. I've worked for West End Games and TSR and Wizards of the Coast and Upper Deck as varying things from editor to creative director to senior designer. Also started, one of the people behind started two smaller companies, The Game Mechanics and Super Genius Games. Most of my effort these days is going into being creative director for Super Genius Games and doing freelance work similarly to the lines of what Matt was just describing.
I am Daniel Solis. By day, I'm creative director at an advertising agency with a lot of national clients. By night, I'm an independent game designer, and I kind of got my start doing layout for a bunch of other independent game designers, and then I started stepping into the actual game myself, and I've been posting a lot of stuff on danielsolis.com, and this is my second game out on Indie Press Revolution, Dope Pilgrims of the Flying Temple. It's a storytelling game directed at tweens in age 12 and up. It's a lot of fun. It's like a lot of inspiration from Avatar: The Last Airbender, if you're a fan.
And your first game was?
Happy Birthday Robot, which was directed at it's a storytelling game directed at slightly younger kids for families and classrooms. But it's also a storytelling game. It's got a lot of support with teachers and librarians. So
that's awesome. It is absolutely awesome.
You're moving up the age though, as you go.
Yes, gradually. Yes.
Okay. So it's kind of like the role play game.
Sorry?
Twilight, the role-playing game?
Oh, yeah. That's
for sure.
Yeah.
That's what the money is.
Oh, God.
Sparkly money.
I'm Jeff Bellinger, and I've been working on Killer Bunnies for 22 years.
He's almost got it.
And I've invented a few other little games, but little blips on the radar. Next year we're coming out with Psychic Penguins. So protect your brains. I do a lot of consulting for different folks who invent games for their mathematical basis. My master's is in math. I love math. I'm the one. Love math? Anyone? Math people? Yes. Number theory. What's some of the other things people mentioned? This is my 9th Gen Con. When was it in Wisconsin?
It was started out in Wisconsin in Gary Gygax's basement.
What was the last? Right, you seem like you were there.
It's been here for 9 years, I think?
Okay, then this would be
10 years ago is the last time that it was.
That was 10 years.
Was it last time.
I went to one in Wisconsin, and I loved Wisconsin, and then we moved here, and I like Indy too.
Yeah, Indy, so, you know, I was born and raised in Wisconsin. I love the Milwaukee shows and all that. Mm-hmm. This is, Indy welcomed us with open arms. It's been fantastic.
Yeah. It was great.
I will not say a bad word against Milwaukee, but Indy, it's just been awesome. Yes.
I like them both equally. Thank you, very PC.
There's not as many.
It's one of the no-nos is don't insult people.
Yeah.
And one of the things, actually, I mean, just kind of do a stupid segue on that, is you see from listening to the longer you're in the industry, the more you're working with people in different companies and people switch around. So one of the big no-nos is to don't inadvertently insult people. Don't be mean when you don't need to be, because it's only going to come back and affect something later on. The person who's your editor at Game Company A is going to be your, you know, the hiring manager at Game Company F.
However, when you do need to, when you need to be mean, go all out.
You got to burn that bridge. Burn it to them.
Right. Go big or go home.
Make sure they never knew there was a bridge there. Well, what should we talk
about?
We're
a little befuddled by this very negative subject. What are you guys hoping that we're going to talk about? I mean, that's kind of a pop-out.
I've done this one a few different years. Usually it's me and Mike Gray and a couple other guys, but we usually sit up here and say, this is how you shouldn't do this, and then we explain how you should do it as well.
So, sounds good.
And it's mostly about game design stuff, like, you know, we'll ask you guys, like, what kind of games you're interested in. There's a whole bunch of different types, like role-playing games, adventure games, card games, et cetera, et cetera.
You're familiar with these?
Yes.
That's it. It's probably also useful if you can illustrate things that you have done wrong in the past.
Oh, that's
We only have an hour. So, all right, that's a good one. Let's each do one of those. That's good.
All right, one of the big... I did a game called Brave New World many years ago, which is a superhero role-playing game. And my big mistake in that was not listening to the hardcore audience, our core audience. Because we thought we were going to sell this game to all sorts of comic book readers, right? The problem was that the company kind of fell apart at that point. We ended up not having the marketing dollars to go out and do it, to push in the comic book industry. So we ended up relying on our core market. Now, the core market wants to be able to build their own powers and, you know, really down to the nitty-gritty of game design. And I had built this template thing where you just any idiot could pick it up and play and go, right? But the hardcore market, they don't care about that. They want to be able to play champions. They want to tinker with the engineering crowd for that stuff, for superhero role-playing games. So I totally misread what they wanted for that stuff. People love the game. They love the setting. They love the combat system. They love everything else about it, except for the power design system, because I didn't open that up to people. So part of that, I think, is just try to figure out what's out there, why people like it, and make sure that you're giving them what they want. You can go beyond that. You can do different things with it. But don't limit yourself in ways that will limit your audience. Particularly, a lot of games actually start out in this market, as we call it, the core hobby market, and then can move out into other things. But if you don't get the core hobby market behind you, you don't get anybody behind you at the moment.
So was that a decision that you made, or was that a decision for targeting?
Totally my fault.
Okay. So I'm saying, it's one of the things that happens a lot when you're not independent, when you're working even with a small group, you're going to make group decisions, and sometimes you're going to pick a target that when you go for it, you've overlooked steps one through three, and you shoot for step four.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the whole marketing thing falling apart, the company splitting up at that point, wasn't my fault, technically. But, but you know, I think I did ignore the idea that I should have been focusing more on the core audience, the guys who are the hardcore role players. That was actually that audience I came from and designed for many years. I thought, let's try to do something a little bit simple that can go out to a more of a mass market, right? But it wasn't like really simple and innovative like the stuff that Daniel's doing. It was kind of a hybrid, and because of that, it was either fish nor fowl, and it didn't really sell to either one of them.
So, just kind of a spinoff. Did you do a lot of play testing with it ahead of time?
I did, yeah. And I mean, people like the game, they like to play it, but the problem was it's not. The problem with that was the character creation system worked just fine. It was the powers creation system, which was non-existent, basically. I said, here's some templates for powers. I'll come out with more of them as we go along. And these are the basic 20 that you're going to need. And people are like, no, I don't like that. I want to be able to build my own stuff. I want to be able to break it down to like little tiny points and then build it back up again, like a Lego set, right? Like champions, essentially, or heroes, or groups. Or like mutants and masterminds did later. I mean, these kind of things. But I had thought maybe I could do something different. that was not where I should have chosen to innovate. The background and the setting and everything else, the combat system and the game system were good innovations. But that's another rule we should do, is don't try to innovate everything at once, right? Because you're, as a game designer, especially if you're a professional or if you're a hardcore gamer, you've been doing this a long time, you get bored with what's out there, and you start thinking, I just want to have something new, fresh, cool, exciting, right? But if you make everything about it new, cool, fresh, exciting, you're going to lose a lot of your audience. Because every time you go a little bit away from what people expect, you lose some people and gain some others, right? But if you do six different things as opposed to two different things, you lose six times as many people. Right? Or three times. I guess my math's bad. Yeah, that's...
So I'm gonna go with a similar vein, I will take responsibility for it, though it's only partially mine. And that's when we were working on the Dragonlance 5th Age game for TSR and Wizards of the Coast, which, again, was designed to go to a new audience. They were trying to... There were the sales of Dragonlance in the game line and sales of Dragonlance in novels. And those of you who are listening on recording devices can't see that one head is much higher than the others, and that's the novels. And so our goal was to try and find ways to bring the people that really love the setting to try this game and to get them into role-playing and maybe eventually get them into D&D too. So we produced a card-based game, which was not the problem. The problem was how we chose to sell it. And it was a packaging problem, because what we wanted to do was get the novel players to get it. So we created the intro box game was the size of a hardcover novel. And we sent it out there, and bookstores shelved it with the games. And if you know going to mass market bookstores, the games are generally in large, or at that point, they were large slots that they got slotted into that are meant for 8.5 by 11 books. And when you drop something the size of a hardcover in it, it disappears into the bottom. And so after that went, and we found it wasn't showing up anywhere we wanted to, we went to our salespeople and they said, oh no, they won't possibly put that on the cover, on the shelves of the hardcovers. That real estate's really valuable in the game store. And so we said, why didn't we know that? Okay, what if we do it as a soft cover? There's lots of room for a soft cover. So we put out what's called the Saga Fate Deck, which was a set of spare cards and a bare bones version of the rules, but it was the size of a small novel or a novella, a paperback size, and meant to go on the paperback shelves where all the other Dragonlance books were. But because it was released by Wizards of the Coast and not Wizards of the Coast novels, it went into the game section and fell even further into the slot. So what we didn't do, and part of what we did and got bad information on, was go and push hard enough on the people who were going to be selling it and finding out how the end user, or particularly how the sales people, are going to be using what you sent them. If it's going to retail to large book chains, which there are fewer of than ever before, you need to know when it goes out there, where are they going to put it? You need to design it physically so it will fit in that space. If it's going to hobby stores, you know you're probably not going to get a lot of face out, so you've got to have something that looks good on the spine. Kind of understanding how your product is going to live in the real world so that the people you want to find it and ooh and ah and gush it and take it off the shelves and take it home and love it, they will be able to do all that. Because if it's sitting in the bottom of the shelf, even the people who would love it are never going to find it.
Yeah. Yeah, when we did Deadlands, for instance, we came up with the ugliest colors we possibly could for the cover. The trade dress. The trade dress is how you make sure it all looks, all the books in line look the similar. So we did this bright orange and red Photoshop cloud thing, right? That basically looked like fire. And the reason was we knew that there are a lot of books on game shelves and game stores that are black or white or whatever, and we knew nobody would miss that. So if they're looking for our stuff, they're going to be able to find it. Also, sometimes they would just say, what the hell is that? And pick it up. As soon as you get somebody to pick up your box, your book, or whatever,
that's
a big win. And then they start looking at it. Until they pick it up, you're just kind of part of the wall, right? Once they pick it up, you actually have their attention. Then hopefully you can sell more of your name.
Let's see. Can I do two?
Yeah.
Okay. Two big mistakes, and this is someone. This is speaking
you
of someone.
A whole hour, so.
Yeah. This is speaking of someone who is more new to the hobby and industry than everyone else here. So just rookie mistakes. don't overpromise. And that was my first mistake. Part of the way I work is I work in public. So whenever I'm designing a game, I'll do it on my blog, and I'll post about it at each stage of the process, whenever I'm doing playtesting, whenever I have new editions of graphics, whenever I have new character sheets or what have you. I'll post all those updates on the blog to get feedback from everyone, and just, you know, just generally to show people where I'm at. It keeps me accountable. The problem is, if I set a date, I have to stick to that date. And there were a couple of times when I thought I would be ready for playtest and on one date, and I was definitely not. And I didn't find that out until much too late. Thankfully, people were very reliable and loyal, and just stuck with it, and they believed in the project enough to just kind of wait until it was actually ready, and then when they played it, they liked it. And so I was very fortunate in that. But still, if you're going to be accountable to people in public, if you design that way, just make sure that you don't overpromise on those dates. The second thing that I did wrong was probably, I don't know how you want to put it, but I make the way I kind of have laid out Happy Birthday Robot and Dokkan's the Flying Temple is in this 8.5 by 8.5 square, which as you guys have noted, if you just drop it into like this kind of wooden retail slots, it just kind of falls in. So that's a no-no for if you're marketing specifically in the core hobby retail space. The way I've kind of justified it and a little bit is that I'm not really focused on that market exclusively. Happy Birthday Robot was very much directed towards classrooms, families, teachers. I also pushed heavily online sales so that the cover worked well as a thumbnail. Even if it would just get lost in a retail space. And I've sort of followed the same track with Doe, and whatever the third game is going to be, I'll follow that same track. So in the end, I kind of saved that mistake a little bit by just kind of saying, oh, yeah, it was a branding decision. Yeah.
The question is, when we come back to the seminar in 5 years, well, how will you yeah. do that in history?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So come back 5 years, and I'll probably say, oh, God, that was a terrible idea. yeah.
Well, I've got a good story for you. I get approached about 100 times a year with someone who's invented something or a game or some other product, and they ask me to take a look at it, or do you think this is something you'd be interested in producing on the side, et cetera, et cetera. And I had a friend in college. This is not a story about me. This is a friend.
Because you have nothing wrong, right?
This is a true story. He invented a gauge. And it was a piece of metal. It looked sort of like a V cut out of it. And you would hold it up to a hex nut, and it would tell you what size the hex nut was. And he showed me he was well into production for this thing when I re-got introduced to him. I had gone to college with him, and I saw him a few years later. And he was just happier than anything. He thought this was brilliant. He said, rather than going like this, and you try this one, and you try that one, and the byline was, grab the right wrench the first time, each time. A little wordy, but the point was that you hold the gauge up to the hex nut, you find out what size it is, and then you grab the right wrench. He had these gauges punched. He had them laser engraved, and back in 2000, 2001, that was just in its infancy. That was pretty good. And the whole point was to get a company to buy into it and have their logo on the back, and it would be a hanger. It would be an impulse buy at Home Depot or something like that. And he was hoping to get one of the big companies, you know, get an order for Home Depot. It's in the hundreds of thousands. And he thought that would be the best thing ever. And he asked me to take a look at it, but he was already producing them. He got orders of 30 or 40 here, and certainly hadn't made back his initial investment. And I looked at it, and I said, all right, well, let me give this some thought. And I read the byline. I read the name. It was in alliteration, which was nice. But I said to him after a day of thinking about it, I said, what about adjustable wrenches? And you could just see his whole face drop. And it's funny to you, but he took out, well, his parents took out a second mortgage of about $125,000 to pay for the startup costs because he wanted to do it right. Mm. What I always suggest in something of this nature is come up with the idea, copyright, patent protect, do whatever you got to do, and then pitch it to larger companies and don't spend your own money.
Yeah.
He spent his parents' money, which, you know, as soon as they're gone would have been his money anyway, so technically that he's spending somebody's money. You really don't want to do that. That's a no-no.
It makes Thanksgiving awful hard.
It sure does. Yeah. So I think the no-no in this is I asked him about adjustable wrenches. And then I said to him, well, who really uses wrenches? Mostly mechanics. And I don't know a mechanic that can't buy a hex nut and get it on maybe the second try. So you got one try, got it on the second try. Well, gauge, one, wrench, two, where's the advantage? And I hated to put a pin in the balloon, but I wanted to be the realist. And when you invent something, if it's a game or an invention or something like that, you're very close to it. And you may think it's the cat's meow. But you have to get somebody else to take a look at it that you don't know, have no investment in, no friendship in, and something like that to say, yeah, but what about adjustable wrenches? Plus the fact that what if you can't see the gauge? You know, if you're working on a car or something, and you have to feel that. That's half the time, too. And so I punched a few holes in it, and he got very angry at me. Hasn't spoken to me since. No, it's true.
Oh.
It's true. He got very, very upset. And I had just started to put out my first game as an independent. And, you know, I'd sold 200 copies in a year, and I was flying high. But I didn't invest $125,000.
Yeah.
My investment was a few thousand dollars, so, you know, what did I give up, really? A few vacations and imported wine. So, you know, him and his folks were kind of in the hole for, you know, a large chunk of change. I guess the point of it being that you can have a great idea. Step one is sound. Step two is sound. Step three is sound. And then if step four can just happen, I've got five, six, and seven, and then we're on our way to the big house. But there's that one step that doesn't make sense, and I find that people have a great way of overlooking that because they believe so strongly in the first three steps and the last three steps. So, again, I was being serious. This is not a story about me. I actually keep one of those gauges because I got a prototype. And I keep one if I'd known we were going to. Seven of them lodged in my car. If I'd known I was coming, I'd have brought it. But it's a good story. It's a story to say, hey, you can have your dreams. You can go for it. You can invent. You can create. But if you're going to do that to market, you have to keep one foot in reality. If you're going to write for yourself and your friends, sky's the limit. Do whatever you want. But if you're here to market and you want to make some money doing it, you need to keep one foot in reality. And for that, you need other people to help you with perspective. So that is the story of the gauge.
I know a lot of designers. I know a lot of writers, too, who take great offense when they hand out something to their first readers or their editors, sometimes even their editors. And when they get comments back saying, I don't get this, or this isn't working for me, that they take personal offense. And if you are going to work professionally, it's really, it's in your best interest to listen to those people. They're your audience, and what they're trying to help you make your thing better. You may not always do what they say, but you need to give real consideration to. They're not saying it because they want to hurt you. They're saying it because something about what you produce has not spoken to them the way you wanted it.
Right. I like to do cold play testing when I do games. I'll actually find some people I don't know, send them a copy of the game. I don't online or whatever. Send them a copy of the game and then have them get back to me with the play test report. Tell me
how the game works. Sending it blind.
Yeah.
Who are you? John Smith.
Publisher's Clearinghouse. I'll send this actually. So I send out to these people. Often what I'll do is I'll find people who hated my last game and I'll co-opt them as play testers.
Yeah.
Seriously. Because it does two things. One is that it means these are people who are good at picking my shit apart. So I'm happy to let them do it before it goes to press. And also because they're usually people who have a strong opinion and want to be listened to. They now, I co-opt them, they are now on my side as opposed to being somebody who's yelling at me from the sidelines, right? So I'll find people who hate my other stuff, hopefully not too many of them, and get them to play test the game. And they'll usually write back to me and tell me how I totally screwed it up. And if you look closely at the report, you'll figure out that they misread this one rule and destroyed everything, right? Well, what that tells me is I screwed up writing that rule. Right? So what you need to do, your rules are your game in so many ways. If your rules suck, if your rules are unclear, if they can be misconstrued in any way, you have destroyed your game. Because they cannot package you in every box. If you were in every box, you could make, we're all entertainment people, we're game designers. We could sit down, we could have fun playing anything, because I'll show you how to play it, I'll make adjustments on the fly, you get confused, right? See, you're not quite getting it, I'll explain it again. You can't do that when it's on a bookshelf or in a store. So it just, so make sure the rules are good. Polish them to a fine sheen. Mike Gray, who I often do the seminars with, will sit there and tell you that if he likes a game that you've shown him, he then has to show it to designers and marketing people and publishers and et cetera, all the way down the line. And they all have to understand it, and he has to try to remember what the hell you told him. And a lot of times he's not even in the room either. So even when you're doing prototypes, when you're sending out stuff for people to see, the rules have to be fantastic. You know, take a good chance and make sure you get it right.
When you say co-op, I'm really a beginner.
Yeah.
So when you say co-op, you actually pay them?
No. When I say co-op, I mean I'm getting them to cooperate with it.
Okay, just checking, because
most people are happy to do stuff for fun.
Yeah. I pay my play testers in food.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I pay mine that way too.
And beer.
Usually beer and pizza,
what?
Right?
They're
just doing it for fun. You can just send them the stuff, and they'll usually print it out and just send you stuff back. But no, you don't usually have to pay for that. Always give people credit.
Yeah.
Right? Credit is the cheapest and easiest and best thing to give people, right? People like to be acknowledged for the work they've done, even if it's just that they said, hey, thanks, or they brought you they brought the pizza to you, right? The lady who cooked for you that day, whatever. Say thank you to people. It always helps. It doesn't cost a dime to actually add another name to your book.
On that note...
This, by the way, good advice for life, too.
Yeah. on that note, kind of tying all this together, honestly. Taking for example the guy who made the little gauge. He invested a lot of his own money into that prototype before he knew there was actually a viable market for it, and before he knew that it was actually a buyer for it. A lot of game designers in the past, you may have heard horror stories where they've just lost their shirts trying to put out their dream game because they knew the way to fix D&D, and so they want to just put their game out there. And so, and a lot of dudes have lost a lot of money trying to do that. Now, we live in a different world now. We have access to media that we never had 10 years ago. So, in my case, the way I try to keep myself in check is by designing in public, and that's how I make sure that what I'm doing here isn't an obvious error that I've just totally been blindsided by later on. Kickstarter is extraordinarily helpful and valuable, and it's kind of brand new right now. I'm doing a Kickstarter panel tomorrow.
So do we know what Kickstarter is?
Yeah.
All
right, so Kickstarter is basically a website that allows people to crowdsource funding of projects of various kinds. So there's art projects, film projects, novels, that sort of thing. You have a desired goal that you state and a desired date that you want to achieve that financial goal by. And people can pledge however much they want towards that goal. And if you meet that goal by that date, then you'll get the money. No one's credit cards are deducted until that point. So really, there's no risk to anyone who supports it, but it doesn't succeed. Thankfully, there's been a lot of success for game designers on Kickstarter, at least financially. Where the challenge is, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in the panel tomorrow at 9, this room, I think, actually, is following through, so that's a whole other subject. But thankfully, Kickstarter has been very successful for me, and it got Bill published. But what Kickstarter does, and it's valuable as far as keeping yourself in check, is that it gives you a sense of the actual market desire for whatever it is that you're pitching. There's challenges to that inherent, and so that make sure that if you have a good idea, that you position that good idea well, that you brand it well, that you present it well, because otherwise a good idea will just flounder if it's not marketed well enough. There's a whole other aspect of that, but I won't talk about it. But basically, there are ways to get around the no-nos that have been established for the past 30 years, and without the high expense of what it cost people in the past.
I know you got the Kickstarter panel, but just a quick question on that. Do you reward higher donations?
Yes. And actually, that's one thing I want.
Reward system.
Right. So you can set different tiers. So say you pledge $30, you'll get a certain benefit. In my case, the pledge tier of $40, you got the book. Higher than that, you got extra things like the first supplement, and you got credit and stuff. But basically, on the note of giving people credit, the last four or five page spreads, this game is made possible by this person, these people. Depending on the pledge donation that they gave, I described them, I had their name in here, or whatever name they requested, and I gave them credit as a creature of the world in the game, a citizen of the world in the game, or as a troublemaker in the world. And I set that troublemaker to be the highest tier, and everyone took it. So a lot of the mistakes that you come across are making sure that you know who your audience is, and when you're getting playtest feedback, make sure that the playtest feedback that you're getting, you're not just taking it at face value, that you're actually analyzing and finding out, is the complaint that they're making really about the thing they're talking about, or is it the way I presented it, the way I've written that rule, is it something that I'm just missing at, if I just look at face value? Don't get distraught by that, because it is tough, but one of the benefits I went through is going through art school. And if you want people to critique your stuff and get a thick skin, go to art school. Because people will get offended. The best practice I ever got in that was professors. Yeah.
Just your first thing, you said it was an educational game, and mine is too, and I know I'm at the wrong convention.
No.
But tell me how you got funding for that one.
Kickstarter.
Really, for your robot thing?
Yes. Happy birthday,
robot.
How did
you get it in the schools?
Basically, designing in public was what really is my thing. Mm-hmm. So I'll design and release board games, abstract games, little card games, that sort of thing, and just put them on my blog for free. Those are just really low investment things that I'll do. I won't produce them necessarily. Now I'm getting into more prototyping, but it took 10 years of doing that in public to really get credibility, for one thing. And also, I have sort of a weird sideways way of getting into the industry because I met a lot of people through doing layout for them. So it's kind of a weird backwards way of doing it. But that was what got me credibility enough to get an audience. And that audience saw Happy Birthday Robot develop on forums, blog posts, all that. They saw it working out the kinks. They saw people playing it, and they saw the stories that were produced by that. So once the Kickstarter actually launched, there was an embedded audience ready and willing to donate right on the first weekend. And we met our financial goal on the first weekend, and there were still 30 days left. So I had to figure out exactly how the hell am I going to get this anywhere, because the emotional drive to see things go over the top is gone once you hit 100%. So that's where you have to go into phase two of the whole process. And it was at that point that I decided if you pledge extra, I'll send this game to schools of your choice.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's how I got into schools. And partly the reason I did that was because one of the first backers that I got was a teacher who had played Happy Birthday Robot in her classroom. And she had pictures of her class. So I posted those on the Kickstarter, and that drew more traffic. So it's just a sort of feedback loop.
But you didn't go to education conventions or any of that?
No. Yeah.
No, but he sure could.
I probably should, but like I said, this is actually not my day job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's.
Well, Daniel did something very smart here too that a lot of people don't do when they're starting out, is that he worked in the industry with other people first, right? If you have a choice between getting your game published by yourself or somebody else, for your first game especially, until you know what you're doing, I always recommend have somebody else publish your game. You don't know all the stuff you don't know. There's tons of stuff you have to learn about publishing a game. If you have somebody publish your first game, you can ask questions as they go along. You say, why are you doing it this way? Why are you doing it that way? Most of the time, people are happy to share that information, right? And they'll tell you why there's, 110 cards in most card games, for instance, right? They'll tell you why the boxes are usually this size. They'll tell you why, we need to have, our miniatures have to be this size and this shape, and they can't be undercuts and all this kind of stuff. There's all sorts of good reasons for these things that you just don't have any clue about when you're designing a game, right? And I've seen so many people, I do consulting at Chi-Ted, which is the Chicago Toy and Game Show in Chicago. And people come in, they're like, here's my game, what's wrong with it, right? Which is a great thing to do. Unfortunately, some people, times they come in, it's like, here's my game, I already printed it, what's wrong with it?
Oh,
if you talk to me 6 months before.
Is he printed it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Literally, I had this family come in, they're like, we mortgaged everything, really believe in this, and I, what can we do with this? I said, do you know Toys for Tots? You know, can you get a donate? Can you donate this to something and take a tax write off? Because it's either that or you're going to be burning this for your to heat your house. So, it was terrible. It just felt awful for him.
That's sad.
It is sad. I mean, because they really believed in it and loved it, but it was just so. Just things like they don't understand how selling a game works. So they had a $40 game that cost them $35 to make. Right? That gives them a $5 profit if they sell direct on every one of them. And they're probably tossing in shipping, so it zips everything out, right? But if you're really selling into the hobby market, for instance, usually you sell to distributors, and they want a 60% discount usually, right? And then they sell to stores that want a 50% discount.
Oh my God.
So you're only getting 40% of the retail price.
That's actually pretty standard.
Yeah, that's standard.
And if you're going to make your game, then if you want to make a profit, at the very least your cost, your components, and everything else, your print buying needs to be roughly half of what you're going to get from it, and probably even less than that, your cost of goods, right? So at the most, you want the cost of what you're making to be 20% of your retail price, right? There's a 5-time multiplier. If you want to make a lot of money, or if you can get the cost way down, you can get a 10 or 20 multiplier, is even better, obviously. Those things are reserved for things usually that are high print run volumes, like Pokemon, for instance, where they got to have like 100 or whatever. Yeah. It's nuts.
The thing you got to think about, too, is just what is your measure of success?
Yeah.
Do you want to be in a game store? You don't have to be in a game store. I mean, if your costs are manageable and you can actually sustain the level of growth that you have, that's a success to me.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily...
No. I mean, one of the things that Mike Gray will talk about when we do these, too, he always says, you have to decide, first of all, are you doing commerce or art?
Mm.
Right? Is this a business for you, or is this a hobby?
That's a good question.
If it's a hobby, do whatever the hell you want. You know, but make sure it's a hobby and you're going to lose the money. Right? You're not really doing it for business. You're going to make games for your friends and family. You'll do them as art. You might bring them to Gen Con and show them to people and play them, whatever. You might even print a few copies. If you have print-on-demand and PDF and everything else, it's very cheap to produce a lot of things these days. But don't confuse that with actually starting a business, which is an entirely different thing. Right? And when you're starting a business in a gaming industry, you need like salespeople and marketing people and distribution and print buyers and all this other kind of stuff. If you're selling one product, it doesn't make any sense to start a company to do all that. Right? Unless it's a huge thing and you think it's a breakout thing. But you probably don't know enough to know that. Yeah,
it's a question there.
I'm sorry, I need to root.
Sure.
I'm totally off base. But I feel like all the discussion so far is focused mainly on marketing or publicity.
Ask us a design question.
Please.
Here are the things I'm interested in. There's some game companies that are all about making games with lots and lots of chips, and some people who are all against that. People have very strong feelings. I'm curious what your opinions are. Another question, I did some playtesting work for a company recently. I probably shouldn't mention it, but it was a terrible game, and one of the problems with it was that it relied on an honor system, but it was a competitive game. I'll definitely be sued then if I tell you what it is. So, but it was awful, and I want to know, you know, some people are all about that. I mean, apples to apples, like this like honor system, but that's cool. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
I think a lot of what you're talking about is design the game for the audience. You know, picking, you talked about, Matt talked earlier about designing a system where the creation was for one audience and the game was being mainly sold to another audience. There, as you say, there are people who like the chicks, and if you sell to them, then you maybe want to take however many you have and add 10% more. But if that's not your audience, then you need to figure out what your audience likes and build a game that functions around that. People, if you're doing a party game, then honor system works great. And if you're doing a competitive game, then it just doesn't. And try to neither one is right or wrong, but they are for different audiences.
Well, what are your opinions? Do you prefer games? I mean, you're the expert.
Oh, do you prefer games?
We prefer games. I like both. I play all of them. It depends on the group I'm playing. I have a group of people I will never play competitive games with, ever, no matter what. They're very good friends of mine, and if they ever ask me, I say no.
And why?
Don't ever ask me again.
Exactly. Very good. Diplomacy has ended more friendships than anything else.
I like apples to apples.
Yeah.
Because anyone can play it. Yeah. And a lot of my friends aren't gamers.
Yeah.
And they don't have the patience for it.
Exactly.
But I'm curious, I have a question for you.
Sure.
How is apples to apples an honor system game?
Well,
Because I played it. Did I miss something?
No. It's if you're actually competitive with it, somebody could just say, oh, that was my card.
Not. Oh, someone could snitch.
Or you can partner up. Me and Bob will always vote for each other.
Right. There are ways to game the system.
I have never even thought of that. Seriously, who's done that with apples? Who's done that with apples?
These
apples?
Don't play apples to apples with either of these guys.
It's true. I don't want to game with you, but I honor you for being so honest.
Vote for the person with the fewest number of cards.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
How do you know? Isn't it? You
One of the things is that most of us probably here in the room are
that's
gaming.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Most of us here in the room are probably gaming omnivores. I'm sure the guys up here at the table, we play all sorts of games, right? But you got to remember that most people who buy and play games are not. Yeah. Most of them get like five games they'll play that they always play. Right? Everybody's got a copy of Monopoly in the country, and it's probably been played less than once. Actually, Hasbro will tell you that. On average, their games are bought by mothers, aunts, and grandmothers in the weeks between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and they are played an average of less than once. They are not actually games, they're just kind of furniture that's put out there, right? Every holiday they bring it out. You want to play this? No. Okay, it goes back. But most people are not gaming omnivores. They find the kind of game they like and they just keep playing. Right? It might be Settlers, it might be Dungeons and Dragons, it might be Magic the Gathering, it might be any of these different things. But a lot of them don't ever branch out from that, right? So you try to figure out who your market is and who you're designing for. But when you're first designing, the market games that you think are cool, right? You go to your own taste, because those are the tastes you trust the most. And then you show it to other people, and they'll tell you how you're wrong, right?
Yes.
And they won't be shy.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I was just wondering, I've noticed a trend with gamers that they will suspend disbelief for certain things and completely chop something in half for others. Like they'll say, okay, I'll believe in Jedi's and the Force, but why does Coruscant not have railings on top of their buildings?
I'm writing that down.
Because the Force keeps them there.
And so I've got to wonder, at what point do you think, what are the matters that people really stand firm on? You know, flying spells are fine, gravity doesn't matter, but...
Well, as a game designer and as an author, what matters is you can only have so many gimmies that people are going to give you, right? That's number one. Number two is there has to be internal consistency to everything. If you don't say that there's something magical about the railings, and then people say there's never railings, then they start asking questions, right? But if you say, and by the way, we have these force fields that go around all the buildings and keep people from falling to their deaths or off their flying cars. You explain that stuff away, it's okay. You need to have an internal consistency to it. If you screw it up, if you're not faithful to what you're designing and what you're doing, then it falls apart. Same is true for game design, actually. If you have, one of the ways I really like to design games is come up with a metaphor for the game, right? This game is about this. Maybe it's about, giant robots beating the hell out of each other, right? In that case, there shouldn't be diplomacy rules in that game. You shouldn't be worrying about things like, you might think about heat, you might think about fuel, you might think about damage system, combat systems, all this kind of stuff. But you're not going to be worrying about, is this the right card to play in apples to apples? It just doesn't fit that way, right?
Let me jump in on that as well. When I see writing, like what you're complaining about, and I've written things like that as well and designed games like that, I don't think anybody may set out to tick you off with the inconsistencies. It's, ooh, we've painted ourselves into a corner. Now we have three choices. We can consistently get out of that and blow the rules or change a rule, put a new rule in, or maybe invent some force field that covers our ass. Because we made a mistake. I think the end result is the audience. If you pull that too many times, you're going to lose them. And then you have this, well, we're not going to sell as many, and why not? You get this feeling like, oh, we've done something wrong. You get feedback, and you say, well, okay, well, I'm not going to do that again. I've written things that were horribly inconsistent and then gotten the proverbial public slap on the wrist and said, well, how is that possible? And then I let that email go for like a week or two, and then I have to get back to it eventually. So we notice that you notice. We evolve with that.
Statement
there
of that audience will give you a number of gimmies, right? All right, we'll ignore that, we'll ignore this. But once you run out of them, then, it depends on how involved they are. The more they like it, it's kind of like a game show. You get more gimmies if they're really enjoying it.
Yeah, exactly.
On the other hand, the more they like it, the more they want to point out the inconsistencies,
right,
too. I mean, the guys who are the biggest fans are also the biggest pains in the ass.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, that's true.
The Trekkies.
There is you have to love Star Trek.
They were just picking on Star Wars. Yeah. Star Trek.
No. I love Star Trek, and I also am fully aware that doesn't really cure every disease. But you know, that's the one I grew up on. So no matter what they do, I'm okay with it.
One thing I'll just jump in here and say: if people are pointing that stuff out, they love it.
They don't give
you any energy unless they actually love the thing you're doing, aside from that one thing that they're complaining about. I call it the fertile flaw. If you make something that's absolutely perfect for your audience, they may not say a word about it, and it will never get word of mouth, and it will never get buzz, because it's perfect. They just love it, and they feel comfortable and serene. But if you have this one fertile flaw that you intentionally put in there that they can go to a forum and complain about and get everyone else to talk about...
This is the peon of the princess's
own. Exactly. You want people talking about your fertility.
Yeah. one last little note on that. For example, in Doe, the setting is very weird. It's a bunch of little tiny planets orbiting around a temple that floats in the center of the universe. And there's no outer space. It's all air. So people can take airships from one planet to another. There's a lot of weird stuff going on here. And I have hundreds and hundreds of words just talking all about that. But a lot of it doesn't matter. It never comes up in the game. Rules for gravity don't come up in the game. Rules for like how long you can fly or how you can jump or how much you can lift a gate or bend a bar, they never come up. So if you have weird stuff and people point that stuff out, you have to also filter it through how much you care about it, how much it's relevant to your game. So if they're complaining about that, then you know, take that with a grain of salt.
And also, I mean, it becomes a general game design rule, right? You and fiction too, for that matter. You're going to want to have. You need answers as the person who's making it. You need answers for all these questions, but the person who's getting your end product doesn't need all that. You need to pull out the
tip of the iceberg, yeah. People, right? You have a whole lot of stuff built there, the whole structure that underlays everything, but they're only seeing the parts that they need. Right? Part of that's game elegance. I mean, getting back to design questions. But, for instance, there are things where people see in a game that are wrong and then they decide to create rules to change them sometimes. Like, for instance, the encumbrance rules in Dungeons & Dragons, right? Which is that they're just horrible. They're absolutely horrible, atrocious. But the problem was that, of course, somebody was walking around with this much crap, and it made no sense. So you had to have a rule that told you how much all this stuff weighed. When obviously the common sense approach is the game master to say, you can't carry that much crap. Well, then how much crap can I carry? Oh, Jesus.
you'd be on the honor system.
Right.
Let these guys.
Well, what you're looking for then is something that's a little bit more elegant than actually having to weigh every piece of equipment and tally it up every time you grab something and see whether or not that fits your strength for that period of time or whatever. It's really inelegant to have stuff like that. Dungeons & Dragons is a wonderful example of inelegant rules as it goes along, because a lot of it's just like, we need a grappling system, let's stick this in there. It just doesn't fit together. As they go along, they become better and better games, actually. I love the original games, don't get me wrong on that. They're wonderful, innovative games, but as we move along, we come up with more elegant solutions to these questions. Right?
You have a question over here.
Well, I mean, this is directly following up, and you've kind of partially answered.
Good job.
But it is a design question. That you have attention as a designer when you have an idea between granularity or specificity, that you want to explore every option that you have, versus parsimony, where you want to keep it simple enough to be appealing not just to your core audience that you've already done some research to, but to appeal to a broader audience. Yeah. How do you balance those two tensions, right? The need to have enough parsimony.
Thank you,
but I mean, but isn't that really the ultimate question? If you're in the business to make sales and to make money, you want to hit your core audience, but you don't want to water it down so that it appeals to just every lowest common denominator. You have to draw the line somewhere. And again, the lovely question, is it art? Or is it commerce?
But even in the marketplace, you'll see that there are markets for both types of games like that. I mean, Starfleet Battles is not going to sell to the same group that buys apples to apples. On the other hand, the market for apples to apples is many orders of magnitude higher than it is for Starfleet Battles, right? But Starfleet Battles is one of those games that you can take forever to play. Or Europa. There was this game called Europa that would take a room this size to play all the expansions. And it would take years, right? But there is a core group of people that love that game. They will spend every weekend of their lives playing it. You don't hear about it much, but they keep selling the supplements to do. So I think the continuum tends to be, the easier the game is and the more transparent and elegant it is, the broader your market's going to be. Right? That may not be what you're shooting for. I mean, like, for instance, any role-playing game is never going to be a mass-market product. It's just, we've tried it a number of times. The closest I think we ever got was Pokemon Jr. Right? Seriously, it was the best-selling role-playing game product of all time. And it didn't sell well enough, so they took it off the market. For Hasbro, it's like Pokemon.
I think that the answer in almost every case will come down to how important is the thing that you're talking about for the game. Now, you can get granularity on all kinds of things, but you only want it to be for the bits that are important for what you're doing. You're talking about the bend bar and lift gates. Like, in the first edition, that seemed like an important thing, and almost every other edition it didn't. It was too granular. Right. But you could make those rules. So as a designer, you need to pick what's important.
Right, but sometimes what some people might see as a flaw, others will actually decide to feature. Right? If you go back to D&D, think about Arms Law for Rollmaster that came out. Right? They had the most incredible critical hits tables that were granular out to just ridiculous levels. But they were hilarious to read and play with. Right? So they took that kind of thing that some people might think complexity was a flaw and made it fun. Right, so if you figure out a way to do that, then you're winning at both of them.
I think we have time for one more.
All right.
How about you?
Design question. A lot of games have some kind of random element introduced. From a production standpoint, do you find that dice or cards or spinners, whatever you want to include in that, does that affect the overall cost of the production of the game significantly enough that you would pick dice or cards, you know, one over the other?
Absolutely.
That you're able to
number of dice, color of dice, different number of colors of dice.
Yeah.
It has to do with how many you're producing. And that's absolutely, I work with one publisher for about 90% of my work. And we often have discussions. I will propose something and they'll look at it, they'll nod and say, is it possible to not have 6 different colored dice?
Yeah.
They won't tell me. Because I think they respect my work after all this time. But they'll say, is it possible? And give me the look. and there are times that I'll
the price point.
Right.
If it's not, then we have to sell it for this much.
Exactly. Yeah. And yes, the answer to your question is absolutely yes. But, again, which is, I think, connected to your question, sir, you have a vision. You want to be true to your vision. But if there's a logical reason that your vision doesn't need to be this, but it can be that, if it's functional, I say go for the lesser expensive. Didn't say cheap. Lesser expensive. You want to make sure that if you're not producing it yourself, you want to make your game or invention as palatable to a possible publisher as you can. And one of the ways of doing that is as low a cost as possible.
Have you ever seen a publisher kick up the quality of the finished product?
Yeah. Like Fantasy Flight, I would think, is justifying the expense of their games by kicking up the quality of all of their components. That's their business model, and they can do that. Not everyone can. For the most part, I think more of us are more on the end of the cheap-ass games end of the spectrum.
That's why they're named that. That's
exactly. And you just have to think about what is the viable object? What is the thing that you are actually putting up on shelves? There is... the reason that role-playing games don't come packaged with dice most of the time is because dice are difficult to produce, and up until now, you couldn't really do much customization on your own on top of publishing a book and then packaging those up into a box and then shipping all those out. Coordinating all that was beyond the scope of any individual RPG publisher's
And if you need dice, you just reach into the cushions.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so.
Well, if you ever... Jim Ward... Ask him about when TSR decided to put dice in their games rather than buy them from a separate company. It's an awesome story.
But, I mean, one of the reasons you don't put dice in book games is because then you can't open the book. You have to put them in a box, you have to shrink wrap or whatever. It becomes a huge pain. People like to open the book, flip through it, and actually be sold on the artwork inside and the rules that you really like and stuff. So there's a lot of different reasons to do it in different ways. Come up with your ideas, and this is where you can work with a publisher, and they'll help you figure out what the best cost-effective way to bring your vision to market will be. Right. But don't let that restrict your game development when you're starting out. Just do what you need to do and do it and enjoy it. But then be willing to make the changes to accommodate the realities of how things are moving back.
One recommendation I'll make is go to Google and Google Talks. They have a series of talks where they bring presenters in, so they go to the campus to talk. what's his name, Matt Leacock, who designed Pandemic, has a one-hour talk on his design process that led to the development of Pandemic, and he goes at length to talking about the number of times that his decision had to be changed because of the cost of production. So that's a decision he had to make individually. Mm-hmm. So check that out. It's very, very valuable.
And thank you all very much for coming.
Yeah.